When your company earns unlimited 2% cash back on all purchases with Capital One, that's serious business. So, Steven at SandCloud got a serious business card, the Spark Cash Plus card from Capital One.
We used our 2% cash back to help build our retail presence.
Savvy, Steven.
And we get big purchasing power, so our business can spend more and earn more.
The Spark Cash Plus card from Capital One. What's in your wallet?
Terms and conditions apply. Find out more at CapitalOne.com/SparkCashPlus.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.
You're listening to Power Athlete Radio, a podcast dedicated to empowering your performance every damn day. Join former NFL pro and Power Athlete founder John Wellborn as he dissects the greatest minds in strength, conditioning, and more. So whether your goal is to be the hammer, destroy mediocrity, or simply move the dirt, you've come to the right place. Now with the warm-up done, let the gains begin.
We interrupt this episode with a shameless self-promotion. Are you pushing through performance roadblocks caused by pain or janky movement mechanics? Knock the rust off with our movement health courses, used by thousands of athletes worldwide, from average Joes to MVPs. Our courses give you the tools to assess and fix yourself so you can get back to breaking necks and cashing checks. Not convinced? Get a taste of how our courses can help you by enrolling in a free sample today. Head to powerathletehq.com and search courses from the menu. Now back to the show.
Talk about Jets? What do you want to do?
Yeah, I want to talk about one more question that popped up in the Discord. And it was a kind of a big topic that's kind of raging in the jiu-jitsu world right now on drilling versus ecological jiu-jitsu. And I thought it would be interesting to talk to you about it because, one, you have a judo background and a wrestling background, but you're also a kids coach. I think it's very myopic to actually split these. I think you need a balance of drilling and learning technique, especially in the lower belts. But then there has to be kind of a replacement of like the positional stuff we do. Even the ecological guys shun positional sparring, where you shouldn't do positional sparring. But I honestly think the positional sparring is by far the most beneficial for me, but I'd love to hear your take on it.
Well, first of all, I'm not 100% familiar with the ecological approach in its like purest form. So I haven't studied the actual text. So I'm not going to be too critical of it, but I will say that
I'll give you the major points for ecological learning, right? Let the game teach the skill is what I was able to kind of glean from watching a few podcasts.
Yeah. That's what I understand of it too, is that there's you provide constraints, and then the two students have to manipulate their partner basically to get to the desired position. You just show the end range position. So maybe it might be when I teach the kids, I'll say, hey, we're going to play. So one of the games that I play is like the turtle spin game, right? Where one person starts in front of the other person with their chest on their back. And then I say, you have to spin around your partner and then try to get your hands around their belly. Okay. So if you can get your hands around, and I'll just show the hands around the belly part. If you can get your hands around their belly and be behind them, then you can win the game, right? And so then the kids figure out a way to get there to put their hands around their belly. But then I have to, if I want them to progress in jiu-jitsu, I need to show them like where is the best place to be in jiu-jitsu, right? There's a couple of like really, and phrase it very simply. You know, the mount is a great place to be in jiu-jitsu, and the backpack, and we call it the backpack for kids, you know, the seatbelt with the hooks. There's two things that I need for the backpack, but it's very good to be there because now your partner can't do anything to get away or something like that. So I do provide them some context though, because if you just tell them, I have two kids that they love to play with each other. They're very motivated to play with each other. But unless I show them, hey, you actually need to grab your partner partner's hands in order to spin behind them, they just end, if they don't hear that, they just end up walking around each other like two cats dueling, right? Mm-hmm. They're just crawling around each other because they just never heard me say, hey, grab the hand. So I've seen it firsthand where even if you provide just the constraints, sometimes the kids still feel very lost. And I think, you know, I could wait 2 months for them to realize that grabbing, or 2 weeks or 4 weeks even, for them to realize that grabbing a kid's hands will keep them still enough for you to go around, or I can show them and they're going to learn much faster. Yeah. I think you've raised kids before.
Well,
so you wouldn't hand a kid a hot pan and be like, oh, now you know it's hot.
Well,
you shouldn't grab it.
So this is like some ivory tower shit.
Yeah.
Right. So in the NFL, and in college and in high school, mm-hmm. there's a certain amount of drilling and technique work that's done. And all the technique work is done very kind of methodically and very slowly.
Yeah.
Right. Like, hey, we're all going to get online. We're going to zone step and we're going to take 1, 2, 3, and it's going to be very deliberate. And we teach, you know, pad level and hips and movement and hand, and you work on all of your timing. And then, you know, as you show proficiency, now all of a sudden that we add speed, and then you should be able to take, and this is where all of a sudden now this thing kind of like branches between high school, college, and pros.
Yeah.
You know, people are like, oh, you know, there's millions of kids play high school football, and, you know, a very, very small percentage of them go on and play college football, and even smaller potential, you know, go on and play in the NFL. What's the difference? Your ability to replicate the technique and be able to master the technique and hold it longer than the person that you're going against who's trying to break your technique. Right. So like as an offensive lineman, this was a realization I made in my rookie year after I got hurt and had to watch a film. The person that maintains their technique longer than the other person is the one who actually wins the most, which you're like, yeah, of course.
Yeah.
Right. So as an offensive lineman, the ball is snapped and I set. The defensive lineman is doing everything from his position to his body, to his head, to his hands. He has all these things available to him mm-hmm. to try to break me down and get me outside of my position.
Surely.
And my technique. If I am so rock solid in my steps, hands do, and I do everything perfect, then, and I'm basically able to thwart him, basically like, you know, moving me out of position, like imposing his will upon me, then I will win. If he's able to like break my technique and force me to fuck up, then I look bad and I give up a sack.
Yeah.
Right. So then I realized pretty on, I was like, okay, so I just have to master my technique and be strong enough to maintain it longer than this guy, regardless of what he does.
Yeah.
Simple. And that was not only my focus on the field, but also in the weight room. Because when I looked at the weights, I was like, okay, I'm going to actually move this weight from point A to point B and then back. And the weight is going to be heavy enough that it's going to try to, you know, simulate like that defensive lineman.
Yeah, but I wonder, when you were a freshman in high school, and did you do a pass rush drill without the coach telling you, hey, by the way, just don't let this defender touch that giant, what is it? The foam.
Yeah.
The foam guy behind you. Okay. You're going to stand in front of the defensive guy. Don't let him get there. Ready, go. And then just run the drill.
Yeah.
They just told you to do that.
Well, they showed us the technique like
exactly.
three times.
Exactly.
And then he said, do this. But the problem was, we didn't have enough reps to be able to do it well. So everybody looked awful.
Yeah.
And even my first couple of years of football, you know, I was, you know, big and strong. And so, you know, fairly athletic. So I was able to do okay. It wasn't until my older brother, Ed, came home from college. Both my brothers played college football. My brother, Eddie, came home and he's like, your technique is fucking awful. So every day after work, we would go to the field and we would basically do nothing but offensive line technique drills that he learned in college. And he showed to me. And all of a sudden I show up as a junior. And like, these guys are freaking out. Like, I'm getting letters and being like, oh, this kid's technique is so, because what they're assuming is that nobody's taught me technique.
Yeah.
So I've naturally somehow done into this. And it was, you know, without that, my brother teaching me, I probably would have never have amounted to who I am.
Yeah.
But there is a certain point, you know, and even think about, you know, Will Fries, you know, who showed up last offseason. Like, we had to go back and just do all the little things like head and hands and feet and position and start working on to get him to open his knees up and drive his hips and all these little things that unfortunately nobody had ever shown him on that granular level. Mm-hmm. And once I showed it to him, he was able to amass it. And now he, you know, he goes out in size 5 years for $88 million.
Yeah.
Not to say it was my input, but just being able to sharpen his blade and show him like a different, slightly a different style. was beneficial for him. Well, he was also highly motivated. He's a good athlete, yeah. And there's all those things in place.
He was also able to replicate something that you showed him, right? And I think there has to be, we have to think about the goal of being a coach is to get somebody, like the word coach is literally just to carry something somewhere, right? To coach something. So point A to point B in the most efficient way possible. Yeah. Am I saying the ecological approach is not a good way to do that? No, because it does get people there. I think there are a couple of constraint-based teaching organizations that are able to get people there. But I think the most efficient way is the way that the student is the way that a student can adapt to the teaching, right? Because the teacher has to meet the student where it's at. So if the student responds really well to a constraint-based activity, I'm going to keep giving him that, right? If the student does really well with drilling, I'm going to keep giving him that. But in my experience as a kids coach, it's a mixture of both. For the kids, I'm not going to tell them that the reason that you can't pass the guard this way is because I saw Leandro Lowe pass the guard like this, and in 2008 Brazilian nationals, this, they don't care. Yeah. All I have to do is give them a constraint and then show them a little bit of the technique of how I got there. And it helps them so much more to be able to complete the task and have fun doing it. So if I just give them a little taste of the technique, okay, it doesn't have to be a super big drill. Just try it one or two times. Then when I give them the constraint-based task, they're able to achieve it much faster. And that's just been my experience. Now with the adults, it's a little bit different in that they need to learn those patterns because as adults, you create a lot of different movement biases based on your experience as an athlete before. Like
physical limitations.
Physical limitations, but also just, for instance, you joined jiu-jitsu, right? And you have an idea of athleticism based on your prior experiences of being a football player.
Yeah.
So to you, you use all those tools, which are necessary because those are the tools you have to be able to survive as a white belt.
Yeah.
And to be able to find a way to victory. However, you start to realize like, hey, there are some tools that just don't fit the bill anymore.
Or there's tools that are inhibiting my ability to get better.
Correct. Yeah. So they just don't match with the way that you're going to progress. So then we have to provide you like, hey, these are actually the other tools that you can use. Right. And it's not necessarily an affront to who you are as a student. It's just more like, hey, this is the way. Do you want to accept the way? Sure. They take a couple of these tools. Now we do a partial sparring where we put you in that position. And that's your best chance to use the tools that we gave you. But it's not mandated that you use those tools. You can still use your old tools or even a new tool that you found. But if we don't show you the way, it's going to just take you a little bit longer to figure out the best way to get out of that specific position.
This episode of Power Athlete Radio is powered by Train Heroic, the most immersive strength training app experience on the market. We've built an online training business by partnering with Train Heroic to deliver all of our world-class training programs like Jack Street, Hammer, Field Strong, and Grindstone. To learn which Power Athlete training program best suits your goals, head to powerathletehq.com/training. And if you're a coach looking to build a business with the best training tech in the business, head to trainheroic.com/powerathletehq. And now back to the show. Well, there's also a lot of technical stuff that I don't think you would naturally stumble across if somebody more advanced than teach you. Like, I'll just give you an example. Like, I've been trying to do Victor's knee shield, like sure. The way he does his knee shield, and especially where he, like, let's say he's on his right side, he's got his left knee shield up, and how he hooks with that bottom leg.
Yeah.
I've been trying to do it, and what's crazy is, like Fleep and I were going, and Fleep kind of got up and he kind of like wiggled past it, and yeah. He kind of like was able to pass my knee shield. And when I was watching VH do it, he gets such, he has such good flexibility.
It looks like a wall. His back, when you say on the side, I don't think he can get any more side than that. It'll be his front.
Yeah. It's, right? It's, uh, it, it's, like impenetrable.
Yeah.
And like he gets into that position, his arms are long. So he's got the two hands there. And it was funny because I had a Fleep in a good position where he couldn't pass, but then he stood up to where he was away from my hands.
You off your side.
And he kind of twisted me off my side and was able to work his way through it.
Yeah, you need to go classic guard, my friend. You have to go classic guard and then the close guard.
And then what I was going to try to do is underscoop his leg and, you know, because I'm a leg locker now.
Go for a heel. Okay.
And then Shanji got mad at me. He's like, no, don't do that. He's like, don't scoop the leg.
Poha, John.
Yeah. He gets, yeah, poha. But now, I mean, after we started working on the leg locks, it it's not cheating.
Yeah.
But I feel as if it's, man, I don't want to say it's a low IQ game because it's not. I mean, it's a path to victory. But I don't know how much talent it takes to just fucking wrench a guy's ankle.
I think it takes a little bit of understanding because it's not intuitive.
Yeah.
It's not an intuitive thing. But there's so much leg. There's so much more leg than there is arm. Dude. Right? Because like you're trying to go for somebody's arm that can easily do this.
Yes.
Right? But a guy's leg is not going to be stuck to their body like this.
I know.
There's just so much more leg to grab. And I don't think leg locks are necessarily super cheap. I think they just unlock a whole new level of fun.
Yeah.
You know, because like, man, it's tough just being like, did you know that in jiu-jitsu, leg locks used to be frowned upon?
Yeah.
Did I tell you this?
Yeah.
Being a zapatero was like a very frowned upon thing. They actually boo you in Brazil in the old world championships.
Well, I think the lucha libre guys?
Luta libre.
Yeah. So they would use knee locks and heel hooks and foot locks and ankle locks,
or the old catch as can wrestling guys here, wrestling dudes in America. Like,
dude, I was watching.
Was off limits.
Who is it? Josh Barnett.
Mm-hmm.
You know, watching those guys train. I mean, dude, like knee bars, heel hooks. I mean,
neck cranks. I mean, like nose scoops, fish hooking. They're like, all right, so if you want to get an arm bar with a fish hook, and they're like, what?
it's fucking brutal.
Yeah.
And I definitely think like, I like Josh. I know he and Bob Sapp are good friends. I've never met him, but the fact that his nickname is the War Master. I'd like to get him on the podcast.
He's,
so if anybody knows him, I'm sure we could reach out to make it happen.
Yeah.
But I think it's hilarious that it's like his nickname's the War Master.
The War Master. Yeah. It's a pretty good one.
It's a great name.
Going back on that ecological versus the drilling argument, because a lot of people think that, ecological is total BS. I just don't think that I think we should change the name because ecological jiu-jitsu just sounds weird. It sounds like it's in a jungle.
Well,
it's constraint based. We're creating constraints.
Did you watch the remake of Point Break?
No.
Oh my God. So they remade Point Break.
But with a water gun at the end?
Okay. No.
I didn't know if they wanted to offend anybody.
They tried to take the same theme, which is, there's a guy who goes into the FBI and then they pull him out and he has to try to infiltrate because he was a extreme athlete, like a surfer, like deal.
Sure.
And so these guys are doing these robberies or whatever, and they refer to them as eco warriors. They're battling the establishment. And there was some guy who talked about these eco challenges. It's one of those movies I watched on an airplane, and I was extremely upset that they called it Point Break. They should have just called it something else.
Just like when they named the new electric Ford the Mustang. Yeah. I still see those, and I'm like,
that was
Henry.
Like,
Henry, you'd be turning in your grave right now.
This is the same exact deal as that movie. But in there, they were like, "Oh, these guys are eco warriors."
Yeah.
So the minute that I hear ecological jiu-jitsu, all I think about is this terrible Point Break movie that I watched on an airplane once. It was so bad.
I'm all for constraint based training, but I do think that students, if you want them to move a little bit faster, you need to give them some drills to do because they need to demonstrate a level of proficiency that allows them to do well during the constraint-based activity. And my background is in judo and wrestling, and we spent a majority of the practice doing drills to show proficiency. And every day it was expected that we do those drills.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.
Because there is kind of like a chef chops a tomato or chops an onion, there is a level of technique that you need to do in order to both stay safe, but do the technique with proficiency. There's like this moment in judo where your opponent is kind of weightless and on their toes, mm-hmm. and you don't get that unless you do. You don't understand where that moment is until you've done the reps. So we do. It was normal in our judo practice to do between 50 and 100 throws on each other. So I would do like 5 sets of 10. You would do 5 sets of 10. We'd just go back and forth on a crash pad or sometimes just on the mat. And we'd even do combination moves, or we'll do a combination and get you moving in the right place and then finish it with a throw. Mm-hmm. Because we have to understand the timing and we have to put the sequences together to know when it was the right time to enter the technique. So then when you told us, hey, okay, now we're going to do randori, which randori just means like rounds, mm-hmm. basically. Now we can put that together and start using our combinations in the practice. Or we'll even do a situation where it's like, hey, the person has a 2-on-1 now. Ready, set, go. Okay, now they have a 2-on-1, so you have to use the techniques that you know from the 2-on-1 to create a counter, mm-hmm. right? But if you don't practice it, you're just going to end up jumping on somebody's leg and twisting somebody's ankle or hurting yourself, and then nobody wants to train with you. I think it's really easy to talk about the ecological approach in a sport where you're not necessarily standing up and moving at full speed. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's easy. I think that any constraint-based activity is going to be beneficial to the student, but we have to give them some chance to try it out with the proper technique and over again so that they can feel that point where the technique does work. Mm. But yeah, that's where I come from. As a judoka, I don't think there's any substitute for drilling and doing the uchikomi, the repetition without throw. I think you have to do it. As a jiu-jitsu player, you definitely need to do some drilling. You have to know where everything is. Not only that, it gives the coach an opportunity to go around and correct your position. Like, it's not easy to correct somebody when they're moving in a round, right? Impossible almost.
I remember when I was pretty early in my journey with jiu-jitsu, I asked Shanji about the difference between, I think I saw a headline that talked about Brazilian jiu-jitsu versus American jiu-jitsu. Mm-hmm. And I was like, what's the distinction? Like, what's Brazilian jiu-jitsu versus American jiu-jitsu? And he didn't say anything. He just said, it's all jiu-jitsu. Mm-hmm. Like we don't do Brazilian jiu-jitsu. We don't do American jiu-jitsu. We do jiu-jitsu or jiu-jitsu.
Yeah.
And so at that moment forth, I've never referred to it as Brazilian. I've never referred to it as American. Like what we do at Six Blades, and they might call it a very classic style, which I think is a lot like, oh, Arash, you are an inspiration. Right. Which is if you ever really want to fuck with somebody who's older, tell them that they're an inspiration.
Yeah.
Like share. Oh, she's such an inspiration. Like I always want to walk into fucking traffic if you say that to me. But I did like Shanji's take. It's like it's jiu-jitsu. That's what we do. Right. Like I don't know what they do. I don't know what the Brazilian. Right. This is our style. Yeah. And there's a right way to do it. And there's a wrong way. And this is the style we do. And so at that point, whenever people ask me like, oh, you know, do you do Brazilian jiu-jitsu or this? I'm like, I do jiu-jitsu. And they're like, what's the difference? I'm like, exactly. Well, you know, come back and we'll figure it out. But I think that piece is a lot of people trying to draw imaginary lines in the sand.
Yeah.
Right. Like, and this is what people will always do. And they do it in the training space. They do it in every space. Like I'm trying to like brand myself and I'm trying to draw a line in the sand between it's us versus them. And it's very easy with name changes and being like, well, like this is the old guard. This is the new guard. This is how we're doing it. And not everything old needs to change.
Right.
right? Like there's a way to do things and there's a way to kind of honor what's come before it, but that's not how what people do today. You have to shit on the past to try to grow on the future.
Yeah.
And
what about my ionized water? If I don't drink the hydrogen infused water, then I'm not really getting hydrated, right?
Yeah.
So yeah, everything has to be fucking remixed and repackaged.
Because it has to be resold.
Yeah, it needs to be resold.
Like it has to be sexy to sell. Yeah. And unfortunately, if it's not sexy, then obviously then you got to find a ways to draw lines around it to make it sexy. Yeah. So I look at this as guys trying to carve out their own niche in the jiu-jitsu space.
Yeah.
Where like, oh, this is who we are. This is the old guard. This is the new guard. This is how we do it now. When in reality, it looks all like the same. Like how you get to the end game is going to be dictated on like the journey you take. But if you look at the guys who are the top performers,
yeah,
I mean, it's pretty easy to see what they're doing.
It's yeah, exactly. You can, and it was Big Dan who tried to do that little argument with, one of the worst.
That's
the
one I watched. Yeah, listening to him kind of argue with that guy, was probably the greatest exercise in futility I've ever seen.
Yeah.
Like, I don't think, like Big Dan seems like a pretty, insightful, like, honest, sincere individual, trying to argue with somebody who is not like it was just that was like boiling.
And neither of them seemed prepared enough to do the argument. So I saw where Dan was coming from. Like, dude, if you don't train this way, you don't get to be like a Gordon Ryan or like a Marcelo. Like, look, everybody trains this way. Everybody trains this way. Who trains this way that wins? And the guy's like, well, blah, 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 blah. And it's like nobody was really prepared for like a decent argument. And anyway, I was glad it happened, though, because it did spark like a little bit of excitement in the community. But in general, people are still going to train. And it really just reminds me of kids in school. So like, we keep kids in school for 7 hours, right? Well, why can't they just do all their work in two? You know, and spend the rest of the day doing stuff.
Because they have to warehouse them parents have to work.
Because parents have to work. Yeah. As opposed to thinking like, hey, maybe we're doing this because there are some kids that can't learn in a certain way. So they have to be here for longer. But now we have to warehouse the other kids that get things really fast. Yeah. Like I was on this side where I was like, I understood everything. I was just like, dude, just get me the hell out of here. I get it. Let me do the homework and leave. Right. And then there was a bunch of kids that still wouldn't get it and had to stay for study hall. And then there was the other side where it's like, dude, I cannot stare at this book. I cannot sit in my desk to like jump and
so there's pencils. A great book on this called The Weapons of Mass Instruction that Matt Boudreau turned me on to. And what's fascinating about that book is, you know, I did my master's work in education at Berkeley. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the information that's presented there matches with the information that I was taught, but I was taught from a different side of it, as if it was like, this was like extremely like insightful in this. And then when I read that book, it basically showed that everything I'd been, it was, you know, basically for manipulation, like to the point where they started cutting kids up into grades and also by ranking them by intelligence, because they were more interested that if you put all the smart kids in one class and all the kids in the other class, the smart kids will tend to pair up and will date. That they looked at it as like a way to kind of like a sorting hat of sorts to be able to like let the dumb fucks hook up with the smart kids. And then they also did it by age. And so like a lot of like the way the school is done, that's why if you look at homeschooling, I mean, you can pretty much teach this stuff in about 90 minutes.
Yeah.
Like, why do they have to go to class? I mean, it's warehousing. I mean, you put these kids in an environment that one, they're not designed for.
Yeah.
Like it's like there's a ton of failures of modern education, and to the point where I didn't send my kids to public school. It wasn't until they ended up getting a little bit older and they wanted to play sports and they wanted to have more friends that they like forced their hand back into public school.
Yeah.
And I've still never been a fan of it.
Yeah.
Just because I feel that the standards and the way they teach are very inefficient, and the time they spend there is like warehousing.
Yeah. Although I do appreciate all the bullies from public school, because then I would have never joined wrestling and I would never have this life.
Well, so that's an interesting thing too.
Right?
Like I also believe that teaching people to not be able to deal with bullies, because you're going to deal with bullies through your entire life, right? It could be verbal, it could be emotional. Like, I've dealt with them in business, but you have a rubric in place on how to deal with bullies, which is you basically call them on their shit and you walk up and you fucking punch them in the nose, both physically and, you know, figuratively.
With the work, maybe.
Yeah.
Like, you can just present the work.
Or you call them out on their shit, being like, what happened? Why are you acting like this? Like, this isn't how we do with things. And I think that there's a definite way of handling stuff that, unfortunately, like, public school teaches, you know, like, I'm always nervous that, like, especially like a bunch of homeschool kids when they go to college and they're like, what the fuck? I don't know how to deal with this type of stuff. I've been dealing with my mom and dad as teachers.
But maybe that's a solid plan. Is maybe
Maybe they're
high times. School. Maybe that's the formula. Is you homeschool them all the way through middle school, right? And then high school, you drop them off, and you're like, good luck.
Figure it the fuck out.
Figure it the fuck out, and then you'll be ready for college, or you can come back home. No worries. It's 4 years.
So here in Texas, they have club sports, which are like team sports, club sports.
Sure.
So like, there's kids at home school that might go to different schools, and they play on these club teams. They didn't have, when I was growing up, club teams like this.
Right.
Like, they didn't have a club football team. They didn't have a club
wrestling.
They didn't have, like we didn't have wrestling, or at least I wasn't exposed to it when I was before high school.
Yeah.
So like, now, you know, Jamie plays on a club team. Cash plays in, you know, LT baseball, whatever. Killy plays, you know, soccer at the high school or at the middle school. So it's interesting to see the way that these club things, and like Jamie's club basketball, it's like 5 nights a week. Like, she practices, they have film study, she has games, like, it's every single day.
Yeah.
And I'm like, she's 13. I'm like, I don't know if I could have survived.
What, like, happened to milkshakes at the mall? happened to just walking around the mall?
I feel like asking your coach and being like, I realize, like, this is how you make money, but we'd pay you the same amount of money if it was 3 days a week. It doesn't have to be 6 days a week.
Yeah.
It's not like Power Athletes program where I have to, like, give you something to do every day, or you're going to fucking, like, wander around like a lost kid.
Yeah.
Like, it, like, we could do like a minimal effective dose. I mean, they played in a tournament Saturday and Sunday.
Yeah.
She had Monday off. She's got practice tonight. She got film study on Wednesday, and then she got practice Thursday, Friday off, and then she's got to play in another tournament.
Man, tell me about it, dude. I mean, I feel for you because, obviously, I love you, but it's also because we have so many kids in the jiu-jitsu program, and I just realize how much competition there is for kids' time. And it's not really, the competition is drawn up because parents are insecure about their kids' future. Mm-hmm. They're really worried that if they don't involve them in as many things as possible, that they're just not going to be where... And this is my theory. Okay. Maybe you can confirm it as a parent. I'm not a parent yet, but
it's
my running
theory
is that they're not going to get into Harvard unless they've achieved at every single club that they join in.
So with the sport things, we have some friends whose kids are in like two or three sports. I kind of look at one sport at a time.
Yeah.
So like, if Cash is playing baseball, he's going to play basketball. Play baseball. And then if he's going to do flag football, he's going to do flag football. So the problem is his parents just start stacking sports on these kids, and they're doing something like sometimes two a day, or, you know, every single day. I was like, you know, for baseball, from where Cash goes to school back to the house, there's like a little like baseball facility, and this guy does like micro sessions. It's like a little 30-minute like hitting session, a catching session. So like 2 days a week, we on the way home from school, Kate stops there and like works on his hitting and works on this, like these little, like, I think they're like 25, 30 minute little micro sessions, and then brings him home and it's fine. And then he goes to baseball practice. Like, to me, like a skills and drills. And then he goes out and he plays, and like, dude, he hit a home run the other day. That was awesome. And like watching him swing and just like his level of proficiency is so good. Just from the fact that we do these little micro sessions. And so instead of like running the kid to another sport, like, what about a little bit of technique work? Like, we go outside and we play catch. And like the other day, we spent like 30 minutes on YouTube watching on how to throw a knuckleball, because he wanted to learn to throw a knuckleball.
There you go.
So then we got these like little plastic or like almost like foam balls, and he was like trying to throw a knuckle and like that type of stuff. So like, focus on one thing at a time. And you know, I'm a little bummed that he's not going to jits more.
Yeah.
But he's doing this baseball thing. And I was like, dude, you can do both, and just trying to be able to kind of manage it in. But it's also like another place you got to go. And I got to battle Lake Travis.
So I think when it comes to that, is I'm never I'm not going to say antagonistic, but I never like, I don't hold on to the ankles of the parents that are like, hey, he's just not wanting to do jujitsu right now. Are you going to take him to baseball for a second? I'm like, oh yeah, no worries. Like,
it'll be here when he gets back.
It'll be here when he gets back. Cause the same thing happened to me as a kid was I started at 5 years old doing martial arts, just like a after school karate program. I left, then I played sports. Then I came back when I was like 9 or 10, stayed until I was 12, quit for 2 years, played saxophone, da 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 da. And then high school came around, I was wrestling, and then it just never left.
Yeah.
Like judo, sambo, jujitsu, it just never left. So I just tell everybody like, yeah, it's going to be here when it comes back. But I do think the most important thing is that kids are exposed to a martial art as early as possible.
Yeah,
because that carries over so much into all the other sports. If you want your kid to be okay with physicality, okay, the best thing to do is put them in something that's contact, right, as early as possible. If you want them to learn discipline, well, we have this story tradition that's been passed down and refined over generations. Okay. Yeah. So we'll teach your kids how to bow on the mat, how to make themselves presentable, how to act like decent human beings. I have them recite the kid's oath every day. I intend to be gentle, respectful, and a good listener. Okay. What does it mean to be gentle? Some kid tells me, don't hit your partner. And sometimes they're like, don't punch your partner in the face. I'm like, yeah, very good. Don't punch your partner in the face. How do I be respectful? Where should your eyes be when coach is talking? At coach. Be good. How do I be a good listener? Do I listen to coach the first time or the third time? Like, first time. All right. Do I just listen with my ears or do I listen with my body? They're like, listen with your body too. Like my ears hear something, my body does something. Yeah. So it's like all these little things stack up. So now next coach gets him, might be the baseball coach, might be the water polo coach, whatever. He remembered all the things his coach asked of him in martial arts. And not only that, he's going to remember how physical he was even as a young kid and be like, yeah, I could do that. I remember when I was a kid and I would show up late because my parents were in the restaurant business. So mm-hmm. we were running everywhere ragged. And I showed up late and Master Lee, I showed up 5 minutes late, me and my brother. And I was much more physical than my brother, but we still both had to do knuckle push-ups on the hardwood as a punishment. And I never forgot that. When things got really tough in wrestling practice, I just remember, when I was 8 years old, Master Lee made me do knuckle push-ups. Even though I couldn't do one, I had to just stay. Yeah. I just had to stay there and just kind of do as many little elbow crunches as I could. And that stuck with me for a long time. So I think getting kids used to adversity as young as possible, right? Where they're paying attention. So if they're 4 years old, they got to be able to do something for 30 minutes and not get distracted. I think is paramount to like future success rather than as many things as possible. So give them micro doses of activity.
And we'll end it there.
Yeah.
Thanks, dude. Hey, and thanks for tuning in to another episode of Power Athlete Radio. Hey there, Power Athlete Nation. Big shout out to all the heavy hitters who stuck around till the final whistle. If you've been soaking in the knowledge bombs and epic tales you've been dropping for free, here's your chance to be a game changer. Swing by klfi.com/powerathlete and toss a few bucks our way to keep the podcast fueled and firing on all cylinders. That's klfi.com/powerathlete. Your support makes a difference. See ya.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.